Can Congress make you buy broccoli? And why this question matters. George Annis is the William Fairfield Warren Distinguished Professor at Boston University, the chair of the Department of Health Law, Bioethics, and Rights at Boston University School of Public Health, and a professor in the Boston University School of Medicine and School of Law. He is the author of 18 more books than me on health law and bioethics. Sorry, that's 18 books. Including Worst Case Bioethics, Death, Disaster, and Public Health in 2010, Public Health Law in 2007, and he writes a regular health law feature for the New England Journal of Medicine. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine, a member of the National Academy's Human Rights Committee, and co-founder of Global Lawyers and Physicians. Following that, we will be hearing from Wendy Parmet, the George J. and Kathleen Waters Matthews Distinguished Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Northeastern University School of Law, where she's also the Director of the Program on Health Policy and Law and the Law School's JD-MPH program with Tufts University School of Medicine. She is the author most recently of Populations, Public Health, and the Law, published by Georgetown University Press in 2009, and with Patricia Illingsworth, Ethical Healthcare, published by Prentice Hall in 2005, as well as numerous articles in medical, legal, and public policy journals on public health law, healthcare access, bioethics, and disability law. Serving as the counsel of record on several major court cases involving healthcare access, she's a member of the board of directors of Health Law Advocates and Healthcare for All, and is also the ABA's, the American Bar Association's, AIDS Coordinating Committee. Third, Wendy Mariner, who is unfortunately unable to make it, is the Edward Utley Professor of Health Law at Boston University School of Public Health. She's a professor of law at Boston University School of Law, a professor of sociomedical sciences and community medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, and director of the JD-MPH Joint Degree Program. She served on the APHA's executive board. She serves as the chair of the Health Law Forum, but unfortunately she was not able to make it to this APHA annual meeting. And so her colleague, George Annis, will be pulling double duty and standing back up here for another 15 minutes to present her presentation. And then finally, under the title Health Reform and Persons with Disabilities, Ensuring the Bridge to Reform is Not the Bridge to Nowhere, we'll be focusing on a specific subset of the population by Heather McCabe, who's an assistant professor at Indiana University School of Social Work. She also serves as an adjunct professor at both Indiana University School of Law in Indianapolis and at Indiana University School of Medicine in the Department of Public Health. She holds a BA in psychology, an English from Indiana University Bloomington, and a Master of Social Work from Indiana University School of Social Work, and then finally a JD from Indiana University School of Law in Indianapolis. And so with that, we will begin with our first presentation on the subject of broccoli.
Very good.
George Annis.
Thank you, Ben. I'm going to give a very non-technical presentation, just as an introduction to this panel, and we are going to have time. Trust me, our panelists are good at this. We are going to have time for discussion. I've been to a number of sessions today where there's no time for discussion. We will have time for discussion, because I'm glad you came. This question was one that was raised by my colleague, Wendy Mariner, on Leonard Glantz last summer, actually. And it was also raised by some judges in the Affordable Care Act litigation. Under the rubric of the Commerce Clause and whether or not Congress has the authority to make you buy insurance, private insurance, but if they have that authority, the question is, what other authority do they have? Can that authority be limited in some way so that we don't get the situation that Chief Justice Rehnquist said over and over again, that there is no federal police power, there's no federal public health power. That's a state power. We all know that. We work in public health for our lives. And, of course, there's one question, whether you'd like to change the law and say that there is a federal police power. That's actually been a hobby of mine for 30 years. But and I always, you know, I always thought that, of course, the federal government can do just about whatever it wants to do, justifying it under a number of different constitutional rubrics, including the Commerce Clause, the Defense Clause, the Taxation Clause. And you put those all together, if you don't have a federal police power, you got something really close to it. Nonetheless, this issue has now come up. This is going to be a major issue if and what it looks like when the Supreme Court takes this case, and I expect them to take it very soon. That's broccoli. Why would we ask that question? Why would we ask the question, can the Supreme Court make you buy broccoli? I don't think they can make you eat broccoli, so we'll leave it at buy broccoli. But the reason is three important cases, and I just want to talk about each one just for a little bit. The first is the Raich case. Lopez versus Gonzalez. It's U.S. versus Lopez. I'm okay, actually. Getting a little senile up here. It's the case where the question of whether the Congress could constitutionally pass a statute that forbade the possession of guns in a school district under the Commerce Clause. And that's an interesting case. Nobody thinks it's a good idea, I take it, for kids or people, anyone, to have a gun in a school district. Although there was some irony that this was a case from Texas, and there are those in Texas who think you should be required to have a gun when you're in a school district. But this case was about a federal law. You always say don't make a federal case out of it. And when the case is named U.S. versus Lopez, and you're Lopez, you know right away you're in trouble. And he was. But his lawyers obviously took this as a nice opportunity to do a test case, appealed his conviction, and argued that the Commerce Clause did not give the federal government the authority to outlaw, criminal statute, the possession of guns in a school district. Well, why not? I mean, the case is a rich case because it's the first time since the Depression that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that there's something that Congress can't do under the Commerce Clause. It expanded the Commerce Clause over and over again since the Depression to say that it gave the federal government not plenary powers, not police powers, but tremendous powers to deal with anything that affected channels of commerce, anything that flowed in interstate commerce between two states, and ultimately anything that substantially influenced commerce, interstate commerce. And this was a chance to say, well, is this in the third category? Is this something that substantially influences interstate commerce? And Justice Rehnquist, who wrote the majority, said no. He said there really is nothing direct. Direct wasn't the rule anymore, but there's nothing that's not in any causal relationship that's close enough to say this influences interstate commerce. And he was able to play off of Justice Breyer's dissent. And Breyer said, here's Breyer's argument, and this is an important argument. He said that guns in school influence commerce this way, that in order to have a productive workforce, they have to have a good education. And in order to have a good education, they have to have a nice, quiet, conducive to study environment. If kids bring guns to school, it'll make the students nervous. If they're nervous, they're not going to be able to study as well. If they don't study as well, they're not going to be as productive workers as they might otherwise be. And if they're not as productive workers as they might otherwise be, the economy will suffer. And therefore, guns in school have an impact on interstate commerce. To which Rehnquist said, you have to be kidding, right? Says you're piling inference on inference on inference, and it's just not a close enough connection. His argument was, again, a slippery slope argument. If you accept this, he said, what would there be anything that this federal government couldn't do? Because it could always say, after some links, some long chain, it was related to interstate commerce. And he was specifically upset about the notion that things like education itself, which is a fundamental state power, would become a federal issue, because obviously education was one link in that chain already. And if you want to make education better, why shouldn't the federal government take it over altogether and just make it better? Why shouldn't it have the authority under Commerce to do that? And he also talked about criminal law and family law, areas of law that are traditional state powers, which he thought finding this law constitutional would necessarily mean you'd have to essentially, and this is the case he used that line, and essentially give Congress the police powers, or public health and safety powers. And again, the argument was that's wrong, that there's got to be something. We have a federalist system. You've heard this argument 100 times this year, right? States have plenary powers. We can't abolish the states and put everything in the federal government, especially school systems. Now, the most famous case, and the case that was discussed, although it wasn't necessary in any way to decide the guns case, was the famous case in the 30s, Wickard versus Filburn, which you've all heard of even if you don't know the name. It's a case, it was about agriculture subsidies, agriculture price stabilization during the Depression, and it essentially forbade people who didn't have an allocation from the Agriculture Department from growing crops on their own land. Filburn, the farmer, sued the federal government saying that you can't prohibit me from growing wheat on my own farm as long as I eat it myself and feed it to my own cows. Said I'm not engaged in interstate commerce. That's a really strong argument. All right? Because even if he was engaged in interstate commerce, he sure as hell wasn't affecting the price with his 23 acres of wheat. What the court decided was, actually he was in interstate commerce, not him alone, but the argument was, if you aggregate it, if you bring together all the people, if everybody did what he did, it would be bad, right? Then the whole price structure would crumble. And the holding that's important is that the federal government can aggregate individual activities to make an effect on interstate commerce. Right? That makes sense from a federal point of view. And obviously it's very important to keep the price of wheat stable enough so that farmers can actually make a living and not all go broke, and the food supply can be kept reasonable and farmers' incomes can be kept reasonable. So that made some sense. That did make sense, although, as we'll see in a second, there were many people, including Scalia, that thought this was a lunatic case. But he changed his mind when the California marijuana case came in front of him. This was a case, as I'm sure you all know, California and 11 other states have laws that make the possession and even cultivation of marijuana for medicinal purposes legal. Those laws do not affect the federal laws that make possession of marijuana a crime, in this case, cultivation of marijuana a crime. And the question, one question was, what's the relationship between these two laws? Can state law overcome federal law? Well, we know that's obviously not a non-starter, right? Because of the Supremacy Clause, if federal and state laws conflict, the federal law always takes precedent. Well, yes, always, except, or always as long as the federal government has authority to regulate in that area. Okay. So the real technical question, since we were after two elderly women who grew marijuana in their own home in a small box on the windowsill and had a letter from their doctor saying they needed this for medicine, the question was whether the Commerce Clause, the federal law, went that far, went into their house and into their growing. And, well, you know the answer, right? If you think the Wickard versus Filburn case is right, relying totally on that, the Supreme Court decided that, you know, obviously these two women were not in interstate commerce, but if you aggregate it all, if everybody did this, if everybody grew marijuana in their homes, it would be awful. It would have a major impact on the price, even in an illegal, doesn't matter that it's an illegal market. It would have a major impact on the price, and this would affect interstate commerce, and so it was fine. All right. And Justice Scalia, as I said, even in his opinion, he said, you know, I used to think that Wickard versus Filburn was a little strange case, but now I see it's really a good one, and it applies here. And Justice O'Connor said, you guys are all crazy, you know, you can't possibly think that what's going on here is interstate commerce. This doesn't make any sense at all. And even she thought even the Wickard court would not have found this to be true. But they did. So the question is, how does this apply to the Affordable Care Act? The question is, what can the federal government make you buy broccoli? Can the federal government make you buy a health policy, health insurance policy? Well, there's a couple of ways this cuts. There's no question, most lawyers would say there's no question, the federal government can regulate the health insurance industry. There's no question health insurance goes around state laws. If they wanted to, it goes across state boundaries. If the federal government wanted to regulate health insurance, they can. They can do it directly, regulate the insurance companies. But the argument here is what they're trying to regulate is not an activity that affects interstate commerce, but inactivity. Right? The argument is, look, in Wickard, the guy at least was growing wheat. In Lopez, he brought a gun. In Raich, which was a California marijuana case, they were growing marijuana. They were doing something. But the argument is, under the Affordable Care Act, when you're asked to buy insurance, you're not doing anything. You're just hanging around the place. And so you're not affecting interstate commerce. Of course, the economists argue a decision not to purchase is exactly the same in terms of economic effect as a decision to purchase. All right? It's a purchase decision. Whether you make it yes or no is of no consequence. The fact is, you've made a decision. You've taken a decision. And so an argument is that a decision not to buy insurance is a decision to self-insure. And we can regulate that decision. We can regulate the decision-making. Again, the contrary argument, I'm not making a decision. Most people probably don't make decisions to self-insure. They just don't buy insurance. And they may have a reason and they may not. It just may not even be a priority. It may never have even gotten to them. So the more sophisticated argument is, look, everybody needs insurance. Everybody's going to get sick sometimes. You know, everyone was born. Everybody eventually is going to die. And somewhere along that journey, they're going to need health care, whether it's in the emergency department or somewhere else. And they're going to get it. Okay, and the government has a very strong interest, including a commerce interest, in seeing that the market for, and now you can take health care or health insurance, and we can argue about either one there, is a stable enough market and inexpensive enough, we can't call it inexpensive, a reasonably priced enough that everybody can get access to it. Okay, and the only way we can do that is to prevent people from, this called moral hazard, from waiting until they get sick to buy insurance, or waiting until they get sick to go to the emergency department. We have to have everybody contributing, because if the healthy people don't contribute, it's simply not an affordable situation. All right, and since the whole Affordable Care Act is built on the notion that that everybody has to have access, and we're not going to have pre-existing conditions to disqualify you, so everybody can buy health insurance, not quite every time, at least once a year. Everybody has access to it. If you're going to do that, then you have to have everybody in the pool, or it is literally unaffordable. Okay? So we're down to the argument, is healthcare unique? Is this something that we can do? Here, those are federal regulators over the healthcare system. Is there, or free riders, maybe you could say that. Is there something unique about healthcare that we can say healthcare is different than everything else? So we can, federal government, say, or the U.S. Supreme Court can say, yes, the feds can regulate this, but it's not precedent for anything else. It won't require us to regulate anything else. And the argument to date, and that's probably as close to winning argument as you can get, is not only is healthcare something everybody's going to need, like food, like broccoli, it is something everybody is going to need. But unlike food, you don't need the same thing every day. Sometimes you need catastrophic healthcare. You need healthcare that's really expensive and is going to be literally unaffordable for most people. All right? And that's what we're doing. We're trying to set up a system that's going to take care of these unaffordable catastrophic events. And the way we do that is by requiring everyone to have insurance. And as long as that's rationally related to a legitimate state interest, and it seems like it is, that should be enough. And I actually think that probably is enough, but we'll hear more from our panelists. Okay. Thank you.